Dad, guess what day it is?
What day is it?
No, Rush? Here, do this one. Knock, knock.
Who's there?
Tuesday. Oh!
Tuesday who?
No! Damn! Oh, it's Taco Tuesday!
Oh, Taco Tuesday.
Okay. Yeah.
Yeah, well, we're not going to have Taco Tuesday for a while.
No. You're not going to have Taco Tuesday. I'm going to have Taco Tuesday. Super Eagle's going to have Taco Tuesday.
See?
Hobart's going to have Taco Tuesday. See, everybody but you is going to have Taco Tuesday.
Well, I'm on a diet, Rashi, so...
I know, and that's so painful. It's going to be real painful when you watch us enjoy our Taco Tuesday on the floor in your office where I've already set up a white and red checkered blanket with a picnic basket, which is currently empty, but will be filled with tacos for Tuesday.
Rashi, can you at least have that outside where I don't have to... Oh, that smells wonderful. Mm-hmm. Where I don't have to what, Super Rico, what have you got there?
Fajitas. They are very good. Muy bueno.
Fajitas, carnitas, we got that pepper chilorino thing you love so much. Yeah, and look at this, we got some agua fresca, and the only kind they had was your favorite.
Horchata.
Dad, we could totally eat this somewhere else, but it wouldn't cause you much agony.
Let's start the show.
How's that diet thing working out for you, sir?
It's working out fine for me and for you, madam.
Yeah, it's very well. You know, we both actually on this Freshology thing.
Mm-hmm.
I've lost 10 pounds. You've lost how many?
Like 12 since I started keeping track. I actually started the diet and was like about 4 days into it before I got on the scale. So I actually don't know what I weighed. But when I got on the scale, it was way up there. And I thought, well, even if I've lost a few pounds on what I am now, that's not bad. So when monitoring it, I've lost a solid 12.
Gosh, that's so exciting. And all we've done is just change.
You.
And you too, man. Yeah. Hey, I mean, it's just, it's crazy because all we did was change what we eat and what we didn't eat.
Yeah,
I haven't had soda. I haven't had Starbucks.
And we haven't even.
And then we've just been eating healthy 3 times a day.
Yeah.
We get dessert still. I mean, we talked about the program and the plan.
Yeah,
you can look at the pictures of the food that we kind of eat online.
But we haven't even really stepped up the cardio all that much. I mean, you and I have gone for walks at night, you know, with the dogs and without. But
Well, and that, you know, we should tell them what happened this morning.
Oh, yeah. Well, yeah, we'll get to that in a second. But, you know, I think now I really want to, now that I feel better, you know, just losing just 12 pounds, I'm getting around a lot better. I'm feeling a lot better. And it's made me a lot more excited about doing exercise. So as soon as we're done, I'm hitting the pool afterwards because I haven't been in the pool in a while.
Which is crystal clean now.
Yeah.
I miss doing laps in the pool. That sounds great.
Well, ours is pretty small. I don't know if you can do laps.
But I found a way to do.
You have to wear water wings and walk. Yeah.
But actually, you know
what?
In
one spot.
If I go and hold on to the side or to the stairs, and I can kick.
That's right.
I can kick in place.
That's right.
And that is like a really good workout.
Yeah, we've got some really nice stairs in there. They're really sturdy. We put in above. Oh, Deuce isn't very impressed. But we put an above ground pool in for the 4th of July party. And it's one of those Intex blow up, you know, like really classy jobs. But it works and it's huge for one of those.
Yeah.
And it's held up for months. And so we just keep treating it and chlorinating it. And Tyler has actually been taking really good care of it.
Yeah, it works out great.
And it works fabulously.
It's better than schlepping over to the gym because, you know, the gym is fine if you're going to swim laps. And there are other reasons now to go to the gym. And I'm excited to go back to the gym. But I'm also excited to just take an old, you know.
You know, there's a lot of reasons to not swim in the water at the gym.
Well.
I'm just saying.
Okay, all right.
Most of them you study in a microbiology class.
Yeah.
But the last time I went and swam in a gym swimming pool, it was when I was a member at Bally's in Michigan. And they had a big pool, and I thought, oh, this is cool because I love to swim and I could swim out here. And I got a little bit of the water in my mouth.
Not good.
Mm. It was salty. It was not the ocean.
Yeah, it's not supposed to be
salty. It's not supposed to be salty in a freshwater chlorinated pool.
Well, you know what's really true?
It was nasty because people were sweaty and they'd get in the pool to cool off. And it hadn't been changed or, you know, properly filtered. And it just made me sick. And I thought, never again. Never again.
That's really worn off on me too because I know that you've always been hot tub.
Massive
like
anti. Well, you know, I'm anti standing water hot tub.
Right.
I'm not anti hot tub in general. I think hot tubs are lovely. But I'm private hot tub, I'm happy with.
Uh-huh.
Public hot tub, not so much.
Well, you know, I used to, when I would go to Las Vegas for like a weekend or something, I'd always look forward to like the swimming pool.
Yeah.
And then I, you know, then you go to the swimming pool in one of those massive hotels, and there's always crap in them. It's crap you don't see. There's like oil on the surface, mm-hmm. and there's
Suntan lotion,
and there's suntan lotion and
hair
and
products. Hair,
yeah,
and
hair. Not only hair products, but just hair, clumps of hair. And the worst, when your niece came out a couple of years ago, she wanted to go to Raging Waters.
Oh, God.
And she goes, and on the ads, it looks great. All the water parks look great. You know, nice, smiling families, no sign of
filth or guns.
Yes, guns or gang activity or anything. And I remember the one and only time I went to Raging Waters must have been about 30 years ago. And I was going down the slide, and it was almost like... it was ice at the bottom, but it wasn't ice. It was a thin, crackly layer of suntan lotion. And I broke through it, and it's like awful, awful, just hideously awful, beyond awful. And I can't with the water parks.
You can't with the water. Oh, it's Carol Ann would say.
Now there are some nice ones.
I can't with the water parks.
Some places like some of the Disney resorts, where they have like those inner tube rides that go along like fake rapids, and they open out into a pool somehow. They do it right, and the water is nicely treated. They must be in there nuking that stuff night and day to make sure the water stays nice. That I can deal with. Mm-hmm. Motel, you know,
motels they probably have a high, a high quality filtration system, pools. As I said, because that makes a big difference. And when Disney does it, they're planning on that many people being there.
Yeah,
you know, but it's just so gross. And hot tubs—that's human soup, man. I do not sit in human soup. I won't. Mm-hmm. You know, the Shel Silverstein has that poem "Me Stew." Mm-hmm. Have you ever heard of it? And they talk the narrator talks about cooking him or herself.
Yeah.
I'll make a stew out of me. That's exactly what's happening in a hot tub. And I have really had a problem with them, since my community college undergrad microbiology course. Mm-hmm. And because she talked about hot tubs and potato salad. Never going to forget either one. Mm-hmm. Anaerobic bacteria on potato salad getting sealed into the potatoes with the mayonnaise. And creating a truly anaerobic environment. So if you have someone whose natural flora on their hands is something you're allergic to, or something which, if you shake their hand or something, wouldn't be toxic, but in massive numbers can be. And there's a list of different kinds of bacteria that just naturally live on people's bodies, because we all have it. Mm-hmm. But if their natural organic flora gets onto the potato when they're cutting with their bare hands, and then that bacteria gets sealed in with mayonnaise and begins to multiply and creates this really disgusting anaerobic, full of bacteria environment, anaerobic meaning without oxygen, you can get really sick. And that's how a lot of people get food poisoning from mayonnaise products. It's not that the mayonnaise has quote unquote gone bad. It's that the mayonnaise, because of the oil in it, creates an environment in which bacteria that will make you sick can flourish. And there you go. There's my potato salad thing. Love potato salad still, but I got to make it. Never. Or someone I know has to make it, because I ain't going to eat it somewhere else.
Never eating potato salad in a spa again.
No.
Oh, in a spa. Definitely not one off the floor of a public hot tub.
I just had this image. I just had this image in my head of like almost like a Benny Hill sight gag. Like you do a lot of those where you show a hot tub, you know, with a couple of people in there, you know, a couple of guys, a couple of girls chatting and the bubbles going. And then you slowly pan over and then you have like this hag witch like stirring and dropping mice and frogs into the other part of it. That's what it is, you know?
It totally is.
It's a real witch's brew of diseases.
And the second thing, I said that was the first thing, was the community college course. But the second thing, what, that's Michigan for you, second, anyways, the second thing that gave me pause, if you will, was when I was working for Dr. David Kolakowski in Michigan. I was one of his dental assistants for about 3 years. He had a three-year-old daughter who went to a resort. They spent the weekend on vacation, and she got into the hot tub and came home and had a rash down her back, from the back of her neck to the back of her knees. And they said, that's unusual. And they took her to a dermatologist who diagnosed the child as having a very severe case of herpes. They determined she picked up from the seat in the hot tub that she was spending a lot of time in.
I'm not really in a hurry to go back to Burke Williams now. And sit in their spa after.
Free herpes.
Yeah. Yeah.
Just it's.
Although Burke Williams has always been pretty good when we were over there.
I don't ever go in the spa at Burke Williams.
I'm a spa guy. You know, I've sat in worse. You know.
Okay.
I was the one who was like swimming in the river in Indonesia.
Well, yeah, with a tiger peeing in it up the stream.
Yeah, that was kind of fun.
So anything happened that wasn't gross or disgusting?
No, not this week.
No.
Can we talk about some more bacteria?
Let's talk about some
hydrophobic phospholipid bilayers.
That'd be awesome.
Lipid.
Yeah. Let's talk about the dogs and what we.
Oh yeah, we had Caesar Milan's folks here today. Not Caesar himself, but they came for a diagnostic visit to see Deuce and Muggsy so that they could see their firsthand dog aggression. I think we've mentioned before on the podcast that the boys are real good at home,
right?
And you frequently hear how calm they are as they snore in the background of our interesting stories here. But when they're out, they're well behaved on walks, with the exception of when they spot another animal.
And then they tend to go a little bit nuts. And
a little bit. Deuce does backflips. He bites his leash. Attack Muggsy. He bites Muggsy on the butt.
Muggsy is very apprehensive. He starts whining almost as if he's scared. And it was really interesting to see Muggsy with another dog today, because we actually, in order to show the folks the dogs in action, a friend of ours came over with their dog and walked around. And Deuce, I had to separate immediately because he would leap up in the air and try and bite his leash.
And try to bite the other dog.
Try to bite the other dog. And he will go for Muggsy if Muggsy is next to him. He hasn't bitten us.
Never.
You know,
in those attacks, he never, ever comes even close.
But Muggsy, you took Muggsy over to the other dog, and Muggsy wanted to make friends. And
yeah, they encouraged me to, and I was really upset. I was like, I don't think this is a good idea. What if they end up fighting? And our friend Adam Friedman, who's another actor and an excellent voiceover guy, brought his dog over, you know, to kind of, so they would have a dog to walk past, and he was very, very nice. He came all the way from WeHo over by Carol Ann, by Farmer's Market.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
To bring the dog over here, which was super nice of him, just to be supportive. So thank you, Adam. But they both yelped, and they behaved as promised for the Dog Whisperer folks, and then the woman that, Christina, the producer that was here, said, Muggsy seems like he's a little more chill than Deuce's. Is that true? And I said, yeah. And he said, so are the two Deuce's worse? And I said, yeah. And she said, well, what do you think would happen if we actually allowed Muggsy to greet this other dog, meaning sniff its butt or whatever they do, you know? Which is, interestingly enough, how we always shake hands in the foyer. So those of you who might be visiting, just be prepared.
Yeah.
But I did. And I was very reluctant. But Muggsy behaved like a normal dog. Once he was allowed to meet that guy, basically, she said, Muggsy's aggression, and I contacted Jill, their trainer, who actually referred us to this Dog Whisperer episode, because what they're going to do with you, Jill, I'm talking a lot, but Jill runs a boot camp here called Thank Dog Boot Camp. Instead of Thank God, it's Thank Dog. It's very cute. And what it is owners and their dogs come, and they combine exercise with obedience training.
Oh, okay.
And every morning the dogs run through cones and they're told to sit at a certain spot. And it's almost like elementary school relays.
Oh.
You know, and it's really cute. The dogs are expected to run and jump and catch things, grab things, bring them to you. So you're combining behavioral training with physical fitness.
And that means I work out too.
Well, what happened was they contacted Jill because what she's doing is so groundbreaking. It's a really good idea. And it's really taking off in Los Angeles. And interestingly enough, it's right here in our city. They said, now she stayed with the boys over Thanksgiving 2 years ago and worked on this aggression. Was it last year? No,
it was last year. No, it was last year. It was last Thanksgiving.
Okay. Yeah. Anyway, it was last year. But she stayed with the boys and made a hell of a lot of progress in 4 days, but not as much as she would have liked, you know, of course, because she only had 4 days, but she had 4 days of 24-hour training. She was able to take them to the boot camp, but they, you know, Muggsy actually could participate, but Deuce actually sat on a little towel panting, watching the dogs go by. And she video blogged everything and would send us little videos every day of their progress. But what happened was Caesar Milan's people, the Dog Whisperer's folks, came over to her boot camp and said, this is wonderful. It's brilliant what you're doing here. We'd like to do a show on this. And Caesar said, do you ever have anybody that wants to come to this but can't because their dog can't behave? Because that would make an interesting show. And she said, as a matter of fact, I do. I'd like to introduce you to the Deanies. And so they called us directly, and Jill recommended them because she said they're cute, good dogs, but they need help. And she said, and I really think you could make a difference. So, short story long, they came today to watch their behavior, to take the video back to Caesar, to videotape us dealing with the dog so he can make his diagnosis. And then when he comes over, it's a very well-oiled machine. They come over, he watches the video, they get everything he needs to diagnose exactly what the problem is, so he knows exactly how he's going to attack it, if you will. And then, from what we understand today, it's looking pretty good. Yeah. Like, he's going to come over and work with the dogs. We got an email from their trainer this afternoon saying, yeah, they contacted me.
So, and you, it's, guys might find a dog whisperer.
It's season 9, baby.
Very nice.
One episode. Not the whole season, but one episode. Yeah.
Well, that's fine. It's all worth it if it gets too socialized with other dogs.
Because, of course.
I'm really, you know, even today, I just said, you know, I really don't want to put him through the stress of
seeing another
dog. But, you know, if they're able to break through that with him. And I think he must, you know, we were talking, he must have been attacked when he was by another dog. And that's why Muggsy's so protective of him.
Yep.
And I want to see if there's some way to undo that trauma. And if there isn't, there isn't. And he's an inside dog, and that's fine. Mm-hmm. But they are very closely bonded. So it's like, it's not fair for Muggsy to walk down the street and make friends with every dog and horse he sees and then have Deuce stuck at home. Because we can't walk them.
Well, and they have separation anxiety when they're apart anyway. So that also makes it difficult because there are two. So it's not just one dog that you have to be the alpha of or whatever, you know. And I'm expecting as much training as they're going to get. Because it's all about the little things, you know. Adam, when he was here today with his dog, was talking to the producer and saying, Caesar's book changed my life with my dog. It changed the way that we communicate. It changed the way that I treat him in a good way, you know. Like, I understand how he needs to be treated, as opposed to me treating him like a person. Yeah. He's treated like a dog, and he's more comfortable because people think it's not necessarily
little humans.
Yeah, well, and they treat them like they are.
And
you
they
know,
shouldn't.
No, because they communicate differently. They have different expectations, intelligence levels. You know, and when you treat them the way that a respected dog is treated as a good leader, they snap too. Because it's a lot of stress.
A Boston Terrier second, and then our pet third.
Mm-hmm. You know,
so. Yeah, a lot of people might think like, treating them like a dog is lessening or something of them, and it's not treating them with as much love. But no, you're treating them as they are, as they need to be treated.
Yeah, yeah.
Because you know what,
a lot
of people don't realize is if you don't, and you know, we'll probably learn a lot more about this if we're chosen, you know, which would be super cool, and we get help. Mm-hmm. Is that when you're not alpha, when you're not in charge of that dog, and you're not treating that dog as though he is to follow you. The little dog, this little tiny guy right here, Deuce, meaning this, you know, this 25 or 30 pound dog, thinks it's his job to keep all four of us safe.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a hell of a load.
Big job for a little dog.
You know, and that's a lot of stress.
Yeah.
And so when you are able to treat a dog like a dog, but maintain your alpha status, they can relax because they're cool. Mm-hmm. They're protected as long as you've got them and they feel like you've got them. Mm-hmm. But there are specific codes of behavior that you have to follow, and we don't because Paul and I aren't disciplined.
Yeah.
And so I want to learn.
But
what
we
those
have to
are.
Be. So you know, we're being disciplined with ourselves. You know, moderating our eating and that work.
Yeah. Well, and they're going to give you and I a personal trainer through this process, so that when we do assimilate to Booth Camp, what is wrong with Mercury? We were just talking about Mercury being in retrograde. Mm-hmm. But when they do go to boot camp, and when we go to boot camp, not only will we be able to keep up, but the dogs will be able to behave and function, and that's the goal. Because the whole episode is about Jill and what she's doing over there.
Sure.
So that's really exciting.
So we'll have more updates on that as you know, over the next couple of weeks. There was something I wanted to bring up today.
That's right.
Just a radical change of departure and everything.
Yeah, but it's an interesting topic.
Yeah, this is something that's been weighing heavily on my mind ever since Comic-Con. And it's something that people have asked me a lot about, and I haven't really responded to it. This isn't really going to be an answer to that, but as a lot of longtime comic fans know, the comic book business is undergoing some upheavals and some changes, and DC Comics is coming out with a brand new relaunch of a lot of their titles in September, when they're calling it the New 52, and they're bringing out 52 brand new titles or revamped versions of old favorites like Wonder Woman and Batman and Superman, and adding to the line and freshening things up and changing things around and everything. And I think that's great, because anything that throws some excitement into comic books is always good, because you always want new readers coming in, and you want to bring longtime readers something new and different, so that they're not getting stale and leaving the books on the shelves and everything.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think that generally that's a good thing, and you know, change is never bad. It has upset some people that books, you know, that they've grown accustomed to or they've liked are not there anymore. You know, I'm not writing Zatanna anymore. That was a book that I started off with about a year ago, with very high hopes, and people really liked the book a lot. I loved writing the book. But ultimately, at the end of the day, she's not my character, it's not my company, and when there's a change in direction, you kind of go with it, you know, that you sort of have to as a creative person.
As much as people want change, they still want things to stay the same.
Yeah, yeah, and I love that character, and I love writing, you know, stories about it. I loved writing Gotham City Sirens and Streets of Gotham, and, you know, that's not to say that I'll never go back to those characters again or to DC. In fact, I was talking to Mark Chiarello last week about a new project, you know, something that Stefan Rue and I are going to do, and start jumping on that pretty soon. It's not part of the relaunch, you know. DC does as many sideline projects as they do regular books. So, you know, we're talking, you know, for something, we have something in the works for down the road and a couple of other things too. So, my portion of that is I'm not really leaving comics. I'm just, you know, taking some time off to write some other stuff, but I will be doing things, you know, as I can for DC and looking forward to them a lot. But, you know, the thing that's really got me concerned about comics, and this was sort of rammed home today when I got a piece of news on the internet. And that is, let me back up a little bit. I'll talk about the piece of news I got today. I found out that a retailer in Arizona, Mike Malvey, has gone out of business. And he ran a chain of stores called Atomic Comics. And I don't know Mike. I may have met him at a convention. I think I might have met him in passing. I do know that I've swapped emails with him on occasion. And he had a weekly update that I got every week, and I always read because he always posted the sales figures from the previous week. So I could see how things like my books were selling or graphic novels, and he always had, you know, generally nice things to say about my work.
It's good ear to the ground, to the baseline community and stuff and what's going on in actual retail stores.
Sure, and you know, he'd always like, he'd have a report, like if he had Brian Bendis or other creative people in for a signing, those always seem to be, you know, do great business for him. Mm-hmm. I just knew that he was very active, and he's one of the retailers that I get updates from. I get them from Lee's Comics and from Brave New World up in Santa Clarita. So I always like hearing what retailers are doing to, you know, bring in business. And I know that Mike had 4 stores in the Phoenix area, and he was one of the state's top retailers. And so when I read with some distress, I got his last update today, that he was going out of business in all 4 locations.
Oh, man.
That made me think, you know, where the comic book business, you know, for a long time has been, you know, in trouble or has been cruising that way. And I think that this really is, you know, a warning call to comics in general that we have to start taking a harder look at the way we're selling our product. Now, I understand, I am not a retailer. I don't know anything about retailing, so this is all armchair bullshit for me as far as that goes. But it's coming from the point of view of a guy who has loved comics most of his entire life, has been lucky enough to write comics, knows a fair amount of retailers, knows nothing about running the business, and the closest I've ever come to working in a comic book shop was 30 years ago when I was in college. I would restock the shelves at Million Year Picnic in Harvard Square, you know, in order to take some comps home from my friend Richard Howell, who was running the store at that time. So I've hung out in comic book stores, and I've always thought they were great because a lot of times they are sort of extensions of comic book clubs or you know, like just rough organizations of guys and girls, you know, who are into comics, a place to meet, and you can talk about the latest sci-fi movies, and that's all well and good. And I've seen the rise of the comic book store over the last 30 years, from the Million Year Picnic to little neighborhood stores where guys were literally making change out of cigar boxes, to big retailers like Comics and Comics in Berkeley, which had a number of stores in the Bay Area, to Golden Apple, which was sort of like the big glory spot of comics in Hollywood a few years back and still exists, to places like Meltdown, which cater a lot to the pros and to and fans as well. And now, you know, comics have sort of slowed down as far as, you know, what there is out there to buy. And with the rise of the comic book store, and now the sort of leveling off and the drop-off of the comic book store, I'm really distressed about that, and I don't know what to do about it. But, you know, not that it really falls to me. But one of the things that I've been talking to a lot of people who are currently into comics, and I have to, if I had to profile them, I'd say they're mostly male, but there are a fair amount of females also. A lot of girls like comics, a lot of longtime female readers. I'd say they're, you know, I'd say it's maybe 40, 60, you know, 40 female, 60 male, maybe a little more on the male side.
Yeah, I think that's generous, yeah.
Yeah, ages between 25 and, let's say, 55.
Yeah.
And I was asking them, especially the younger, you know, toward the younger spectrum, where did you get your comics when you were a kid? How were you introduced to comics? And most of them said you know, quite frequently an older sibling had comics, so they were exposed to them that way. But a lot of them said, I would get my comics, my parents would buy my comics at like the 7-Eleven or the drugstore or supermarket or something like that. And then I would talk to kids younger than 25, you know, or like from age 8 to like early 20s, and most of them don't buy comics at all. They don't get them. They don't see them.
Yeah.
And
they're not available to them.
They're not available to them. And my brother said something interesting when he had his kids, and this is going back a few years, but he said, you know, I have to tell you, the most unwelcome place for a parent is in a comic book store. And I want to introduce my kids to comics. And this was around the time the animated series had been running maybe a year or two, so that would be like the mid to early 90s. And I had to agree with him that, you know, 10 years before, when he would have been in college, I'll go in the comic book store, the head shop, anything, no problem.
Yeah.
But to take a kid into a comic book store where they're teenagers, where they're, you know, you might have some heavy metal music going, where it's, you know, imagery ranges from everything from Betty Boop to Witchblade.
Yeah.
You know, you really don't know how to filter that stuff out. And sometimes, and to a lot of parents, they think it's not worth it to go to a place like that just to find, you know, to relive a little bit of my childhood because I don't know what to pick out for my kid.
It feels like bringing your child into a men's social club.
Well, yes, to a great degree. And, you know, and I've said in the past that I've gone into some places with professionals where I actually felt I was intruding on the people who worked there who, you know, we were treated, you know, with limited tolerance because we were intruding on the weekly comic book club meeting. It's been very interesting, you know, especially this last year at Comic-Con. They were celebrating the 25 years since Watchmen came out and Dark Knight. And they said that, you know, 86 was a pivotal year for comics in a lot of ways. And it was. And they said that's the year that comics grew up. And you saw the rise of, you know, Alan Moore had been working for years prior to that, but he really took on and captivated a lot of American audiences. And, you know, 5 years after that, you'd have Neil Gaiman making his mark on with Sandman and, and with the Vertigo line. And there was really a lot of great diversity for...
They pulled the veil and made it more of an art medium and an all-ages thing, I guess, right?
Right.
Yeah.
And so the retailers followed, and you saw the rise of the retail store, the comics-only retail store. And I think that also happened as a result of Diamond being the only distributor in the game as well. And still, you know, you can look here and there and you can still find them in newsstands and still out of the way places. But it was very interesting for me to hear, you know, recently that a lot of people were exposed to comics like at 7-Eleven and, you know, convenience stores and everything. And just this afternoon I went out. There are 4 7-Elevens within, you know, a 20-minute drive of my house.
Yeah.
You know, here in Burbank, you know, there are a lot of convenience stores. There are some newsstands and everything. And with the exception of the 7-Eleven closer to the airport, which I couldn't get to in time, you know, for the podcast, I went to 3 of them and none of them stocked anything like comics. The only thing they stocked was Mad Magazine.
Yeah, I don't think any of them stock comics. You can only get them at, like, maybe a more thorough magazine stand.
Yeah, and
those are still 2 months old.
Yes, yeah, and I remember when I was a kid, every 7-Eleven I knew had a spinner rack, and I would go into those and I could always find them there. I grew up in a little town called Orinda, California, which is over near Berkeley. And I would get my comics at Bill's Drugs in Orinda. There we had a spinner rack. And one of the great joys I had as a professional was around 94, 95, going in and finding a copy of Batman Adventures that I'd written on the same rack where, years ago, I would buy my own comics. And I thought, it's kind of come full circle. And I don't know if they still stock comics there. I haven't been, you know, home to that town in a while. But I know that places like that are less and less and disappearing very fast. And I feel that with the comics industry changing so much, and with, you know, when I heard about the trouble Mike was having keeping 4 stores open, you know, we've kind of put all our eggs in one basket. I think the retail stores are a great place to go and a great place to socialize, and there's a great diversity of product there. But I think, you know, we've cut ourselves off at the legs by depriving ourselves of an industry of the few places a kid can go and be exposed to see comics.
Once we made that transition and put our faith into Diamond, it became a collectible market. And once you have a collectible market, you can't return any of those things as magazines like all these stores used to do.
Right.
And when you can't make an investment in something and just trust the fact that you can return it, you're making a gamble. And all these stores don't do that. They'll never turn to Diamond because of that. And if that's our only distributor, that's all we'll get. Because
that sort of business attitude has always been fine as long as the retail stores, the retail stores were on the rise and the specialty mm-hmm. stores. And we're looking back at the 90s when there was a lot of prosperity in the country and we had a lot of people who are now in their mid to late 30s, verging on 40, who are getting their first jobs in their 20s, late teens and early 20s. Suddenly, everybody had jobs and a lot of young people had disposable income. And you mm-hmm. saw a lot of people buying. I remember going out with friends to places like Virgin Megastore when they first started with DVDs. Mm-hmm. And it was not uncommon to blow $100 on DVDs and CDs and things like that and then run over to a trip to the comic book store. I'll tell you, that was my Wednesday for more Wednesdays than I can tell you back when I was working at Warner Brothers on the stuff steadily, because we worked in a near a mall. There was a Virgin mm-hmm. There was a Tower Records right there, and we every Wednesday you'd see guys coming out with the latest CD releases. We'd go down the street to Forbidden Planet or one of the comic book stores, load up on comics, come back, and that was money and time well spent.
I think that's a very familiar path for a lot of our audience, because I started off getting my comics in a grocery store, got my Batman right before Nightfall, and then I moved on to the specialty comics when I started getting a job.
Sure.
And went to the comic book stores and started getting like little knickknacks and cards and the posters and the books and the anything that was comic related, toys, because I had the money for it. And then I got to a point where I started having to afford more than just my life at home, and I couldn't afford that many. I couldn't afford that much comics.
Now I think the comic book industry survives solely, mm-hmm. Ezra, off guys like you mm-hmm. and other young adults who are still making comics a part of their life, and who and I think that we still have that 25 to 30 year age range of 25 to 55 of people who are still using that their disposable income to keep those stores open and to keep buying the product. Yeah. There's always room for variance, and there's always parents will buy things for their kids. I'm not really talking about them. I'm talking about in general as I see it, which allows for a lot of room for error. But we're talking about we're talking about customers who know where to get the stuff, who have had an affinity for comics, who've grown up with it. Where we have screwed up as an industry is we've forgotten a few steps before that. There mm-hmm. is the kid who sees it at the market who wants it. But the key element that we've left out of all of this is the mom. And this is a big part of it. Yeah. And this is something that I've mentioned. It's like revealing the smoking gun or the fatal clue in a mystery. And when I've said it, when I've mentioned it to peers in the business, they'll go, "Moms don't read comics." And I say, "Yes, but they buy them."
Yes.
And we have cut
them. And they take you to the places that buy them.
Exactly. Because you look at the business, you look at what's really keeping the comic book companies going, and it's not comics, it's licensing. Mm-hmm. And the licensing comes from things like sneakers, like t-shirts.
That's why Disney like put toys. Those Marvel. That's...
Exactly. Mm-hmm. I see a lot of little kids, I see 5-year-old kids running around wearing Wolverine t-shirts, but they don't know a Wolverine comic book, and the parent doesn't know where or if there's a Wolverine comic book. But a mom goes to Target or Walmart, and she will get a kid. She might even get him like the Heath Ledger Joker t-shirt because she thinks it's funny, or she saw the movie or something. The mom does most of the shopping in this country. Moms do most of the shopping. And if you put comic books in an era, in a place where moms go, which would be the Walmart, which would be the supermarket, which would be the drugstore, and the kid goes everywhere when a little boy or girl is, goes with mom before they start school. I remember going with my mom and, looking at newsstand racks and saying, "Can I have that? It looked like it mm-hmm. was colorful." I'd watch Huckleberry Hound at night. There's Huckleberry Hound in a comic book. Can I have that?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, here's a Huckleberry Hound comic book. And then I would read that, and then I would go back for another one, and then I would see, Archie. Let me check that out. Or Hot Stuff. Hey, that looks like fun, too.
Oh, yeah.
And that's
Casper
where it's...
Casper the Friendly Ghost.
Casper the Friendly Ghost.
Drugs.
And now... yeah, right.
I did.
Yeah. And I'm not saying that we should load up the comic book shelves with... and those comics are, long gone. Gold Key, that was really, what we need now is a Gold Key equivalent that's going to keep, start kids off. And I'm not saying that we should load up the shelves with Tiny Titans and Looney Tunes or even Jingle Bell or something like that. Selling more of those isn't really the answer. The answer is getting, kind of parent-friendly product, a place where parents go with their kids. parents don't take the little ones. They don't take 3 and 4 years to the comic book store. Not in any appreciable numbers that's going to keep this industry going.
What has they got? They're usually just dropping them off there to be babysat for a while. I know that from when I worked at a comic book store. You get the kids that come in, they're there for an hour while their mom's next door, and then they leave.
Well, you know, like, to digress for just a second, some very smart and savvy retailers are doing that. They are turning the comic book stores, or at least allowing space for children's books in comic book stores. Like Brave New World, Adam in Portland, who run Brave New World in Santa Clarita, have made their comic book store a family-friendly destination. Mm-hmm. They have art classes there. They have, I believe they have trick-or-treating around, you know, Halloween.
It's very well lit, open spaces.
It's well lit. You can find toys there that a kid, you know, that a parent might not find easily at a Toys R Us because they tend to sell out. But there is a little children's book section up front where a kid would come in. And
only that, iconic merchandising pretty much tapestrying the store instead of like the nude girls in bikinis from Wildstorm or something.
Sure, sure. And that's all very important. And I think for families that have a history of reading comics, that's a great place to go. However, there has to be something. You have to start putting those at the Rite Aid and the CVS and the places where, you know, a parent who knows who Batman and Superman is, but, you know, wouldn't go into a comic book store, where they will go with their kids. And also, I think there has to be some soul searching done as what is the product, you know, you're putting out there. And here's that gets back to, I'm saying, you don't have to make everything scaled down or the animated series design or something kid friendly, because kids are always going to reach up a little higher. But you can't really put Watchmen or Killing Joke on the shelves and expect a parent to buy it for the kid. Yeah. You know, in a perfect world, you know, I met with an executive at a comic book company and we were discussing something like this about 2 years ago. And I said, it's not the content of the books that matters. It's just getting the books where a kid can see them and want them when a parent is going to buy them. Because at that age, a kid doesn't have any spending money of his own. You know, 4 years old, you're not really giving a kid an allowance. And that's part of my problem with you know, the next 1-2 punch, which is like, oh, well, don't worry about the comic book store. We're going digital. What kid, what 4-year-old has a credit card? What 4-year-old is going to be allowed to go online and download a comic book? It works for the fans. Now the fans don't have to go to the store. They can just download it on their Kindle. But comics have always been a very tactile medium. A kid gets it. Yeah. You know, a parent buys a magazine. Here's a magazine for the kid. And it has a character he knows
now
for TV.
Now they can go sit in the corner and read it for an hour.
Yeah. And even if he doesn't understand everything, he can kind of puzzle through it. Mm-hmm. And I think that the business has become very fan-driven. You know, it sells to fans. It's fans creating stuff for fans. And that is a marketplace that's shrinking because the 35 or the 40-year-old fan today who's going in and buying, you know, every Marvel and DC he can afford, within about 5 or 6 years,
less and less disposable income.
You know, if he's got kids, they're going to be wanting to go to college, and even like the older end of the fan base, very soon they're going to have to make the decision, do I want to get every Marvel comic or do I want to, you know, get my Nexium copay? Not that we're all turning into geezers, but there other things happen, you know, and that's part of life. And if we can keep the comics affordable and attractive to a family audience and to kids, you know, and to parents, that's really going to keep us going more than anything else. And, you know, I had a talk that was very interesting with a executive at Warner Brothers Home Video. This is going back some years, but it also, and at the time I actually argued with him, and I, for years I thought, boy, that guy, he doesn't know what he's talking about. But I really kind of see the wisdom of what he says, even though I still disagree with the way he handled it. I'll give you the specific example. We had some episodes of some of the superhero stuffs, like Batman and Superman, I forget exactly which one, coming out on DVD. And I really hated the cover art. It was for video and for DVD. Okay. And when I saw the cover art for I remember what it was. It was a Batman Superman movie. I looked at it and I thought, this is awful.
The one that's out now, or
I don't know how they've changed.
Since Art Deco, sort of pastel colored.
Yes, they've since upgraded a lot of the look of their DVD releases. But I remember at the time, and it was still pretty new for them too. So I'm sure they had to get their footing going. But I remember looking at the artwork, and I thought, this kind of looks like very candy colored licensing art. It looks like they took. Mm-hmm. poses of the characters out of a coloring book and just slopped a lot of pink and purple on them. Mm. And I said, that, you know, we've got a whole staff of people here who would kill to who could give you a really stunning looking cover. You know, just pay, throw them a, you know, a couple bucks under the table. And they said, well, we don't do that. We have our own licensing people to do that. And I said, but look, come on, this looks like My Little Pony here, you know, the coloring on this. And the guy said something, and he said, you know what, we really do that to catch the eye of the parents, to catch the eye of the mom. And my attitude was, mom doesn't care. Mom's not buying this to watch it. No, she's not. But she's buying it to give it to a kid. And his point of view was, this has to look kind of family friendly in order to get a mom to buy it. Now, I still dispute, you know, the choice of the artwork and everything like that. But now I see his point, because if you put it in that context, the parent is the one, usually the mother or the grandmother, is out buying for the child. And they need to, they know that a shirt with a vintage look of the thing going, it's clobbering time, is nice and funny. A image of Wolverine currently gutting somebody is not so family friendly. Yeah. And I'm saying that this is a world that can accommodate both. But I think that where, like I'm going back and saying, and forgive me for repeating myself, where we've cut ourselves off at the knees is we've forgotten the family and we've forgotten the kids.
You know, that makes sense. Because when you say that, I remember buying the first Batman comic at the store. But a lot of the comics after that were usually because I was sick and my mom went to the store to get my drugs at the pharmacy.
Sure.
And she'd go, oh, he likes comics. I'll grab him this one and this one, this one. And take those home to him.
Yeah.
What a nice mom you had.
Oh, she was awesome.
Yeah, I remember being, you know,
she's still around, that's cool.
I remember being about 16, 17, you know, just wanting, you know, it would be summer vacation. We would go up to, we had a house up at Lake Tahoe, and there was a 7-Eleven down near Zephyr Cove, and we could always get comics. And granted, the only thing this guy stocked three comics. Well, it was Harvey Comics, so that was one type of comics. Yeah. You could buy Wendy the Good Witch, or Hot Stuff, or Casper, or you could buy Sabrina or Josie from the Archie series, line.
Yeah.
And then every once in a while, I'd find a copy of King Kull or Conan. You know? But I know that, okay, stop at the 7-Eleven, I'm going to get my Archie fix and buy, you know, Josie and the Pussycats and Hot Stuff. And I was 16, you know? Mm-hmm. But I didn't care because it was vacation and I knew that was a place I could buy comics. There weren't a lot of places to buy them around the lake. And when you're a comic addict, you'll check out Hot Stuff. You don't care.
Those funny cartoons you can even appreciate then because you grew up with them.
Yeah, or else, I think Charlton had the Hanna-Barbera characters at that time.
Oh, there you go.
I'll take that too. Anything. Just, I'm sitting in the hammock. I want to read something that isn't a mystery novel or a big, heavy romance novel. What is that? Laugh Olympics? I'll take it. Please. Thank God. You know,
anything. Oh, you take that now.
Oh yeah,
I love Laugh Olympics.
I actually have the artwork for most of a whole Laugh Olympics story. I traded some of my extra TV Tinykins to Mark Evanier for original art pieces. How geeky is that?
Wow,
that's double super geeky that I have TV Tinykins and I would have swapped them to Mark Evanier for Scott Shaw pages.
You guys geeked each other out.
Yeah,
that's both making me sick.
Yeah, I know that's super geek Nova time. But going back to what I think
a universe,
you know,
just exploded somewhere.
If you're
probably an alternate universe.
Yeah. Earth one.
And I really think that, you know, you can change up your line. You can start an adult line. You can start a kid's line. You can do whatever, you know, and it's all worth experimenting with. It's all good. But I really think that what the major experiment that has to happen is that the publishers, all publishers, you know, like DC, Marvel, Archie's already there. Archie's doing great.
Their point of purchase, like their point of sale, stocking is excellent because you can still buy an Archie comic at the grocery store, at the cash register. You can at our grocery store.
Yeah, you can buy a
digest. I see them there all the time.
You can buy a digest, and now they've introduced this new character, Kevin Keller, into the comic books as the first, you know, kind of, you know, friendly gay character into comics. And so kids are into that, and that's terrific. And they're getting a lot of press, and that really helps the whole line sell. And but it's more than that. It's like you can find an Archie comic. It is. And to this day, when I'm checking it out, I'll go like, oh, here's a Betty and Veronica digest. Or here's an Archie digest. I'll thumb through it. Put it back. And then,
they got under that
border. Well, and so can a mom. A mom who's waiting for her groceries as they're being checked out in line can flip through that and say, here you go, Junior. This doesn't look too objectionable.
Yeah.
Enjoy.
It's the same way with like, you know, there are a couple of coloring books over at the magazine rack at our store. Girl will, you know, I always see little girls over there picking up the Disney Fairies coloring books.
Mm-hmm.
Or there's every time they put out a Pixar movie, there's like a Pixar display that had, you know, Toy Story or Cars, and a kid can go over and get one of those. Why not Superman? Why not Spider-Man? Why not? you know, bring back the rack. That is my, you know, rather than the new 52, which is fine. I say bring back the rack. Bring back the spinner rack and get that going in comic book stores.
I agree with you mostly, but I still believe that our main stopping point is the diamond distribution system.
Well, then we need to have a big sit down.
That's how Archie gets past it. That's how Mad, that's how all those children's book gets past it. They're all magazines. They aren't the single issue periodicals.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I don't know. I think that some heavy negotiations and, like, to the point of life-saving conversation, a council of war, however it goes down, has to go down between the major publishers and the distributor, and a way of figuring out, look, guys, we have got to figure out a way of, like we used to say in the Lost Writing Room, the secret to the show was survive together, die alone. Mm-hmm. And that is what, you know, if, you know, we have got to stay, figure out a way to save this, because the comic book stores are great. They'll always be around, but more and more of them will die off as the economy changes, as we have less and less people who can afford to buy the $300 Alan Scott Green Lantern, or the rendered Bottle City of Kandor.
Yeah.
Somebody will always be able to buy those. Someone will always be able to buy the original art they put on the wall and everything like that. But the rank and file guys coming in weekly to buy their comic books aren't. You know, or they can't. They can't sustain the stores.
The turnover is going to die out eventually. We need to keep it new and fresh and keep more coming in.
And then it'll become harder and harder to run back to the newsstand, if not impossible. Mm-hmm. And so we have to start planning now to put the product in the hands of kids. And as much as we, you know, and I sound really weird for saying this, because I love Watchmen and I love Killing Joke and I love Dark Knight and I love all those things.
Oh, yeah.
But I'm reminded of a saying, you know, I forget the context, and I'm probably misquoting the poem, but there is a poem, you know, that has in it, when I was a child, I played with childish things, you know, and you put those childish things aside. And I think for the sake of the comic book industry, the childish things we have to put aside is Dark Knight, is Watchmen, is the Killing Joke, for the betterment of always have them, always keep them in print, always make them accessible, but you can't build the industry on those, and you can't keep aging up the books in order to keep the audience interested, because at some point they're going to lose interest. You've got to start over from the ground level and get comic books that they don't have to be kiddie comic books, but they have to be a little less than what they are. They have to be a little less graphic or a little less sophisticated or a little, they have to be kind of kid and parent friendly, so that when a mom picks it up, she goes, oh, would you like that? Sure. So she buys it without hesitation. Mm-hmm. And that can have Batman slugging the Joker on the front or Spider-Man fighting Doc Ock for the 19th time and it'd still be drawn in the classic, you know, superhero style. But when the parent flips through it, you know, here's where the question of content comes in, and that's something, you know, people are going to have to worry about. Do we go back to a type of storytelling that worked for us in the 80s? You know, or the late 70s, when Marshall Rogers was drawing Detective and Steve Englehart was writing it, and it had kind of a fun feel to it, but it still kind of worked on both levels. Or, you know, because I think to go totally adult on this and put that in the same areas, that also shoots us in the foot, you know?
You don't have to be cutting edge and pushing boundaries just to make something fun and interesting and something that people will be drawn towards.
Right. Right.
You know, it got attention at one point, but doesn't mean it's always going to be that way.
So. Right. I mean, you've got to, you know, like as weird as it sounds, you know, we cut the moms out of the business and, you know, we kind of cut our own throat because, you know, when a kid grows up after age 10 or 12, doesn't need mom to buy things for them. But, you know, to make that first purchase, you have to engage the parent or the older sibling who's going to spend that, you know, $3 to $5 and buy the kid a comic when he wants it. The same kid who wants a copy of the, you know, the Cars Little Golden Book, you know, things like that. And you lose them. That's the seed you have to plant in order to have a flourishing industry.
And there's a desire there for it. I mean, personally, I have comics with me all the time. It's just who I am. Sometimes I'm in a doctor's office reading a comic. I finish with a Spider-Man comic. I see a kid that's just going crazy because he's bored. I'll be like, hey, mom, do you mind if I give this to your kid? Like, oh, yeah, sure. He'll be quiet as a lamb, just totally enthralled with it. Where do you get that? Where do you get those comics? That's
sure.
That's the first thing I ask you, because they didn't realize that was an option.
Sure. I mean, you know, you look at, or, you know, here's a good example, Bongo Comics.
Oh,
They come out every month. They come out with Simpsons, Bart Simpson stories, occasional Futurama. Radioactive Man stories, Futurama. You know, you could put those in the store.
Roswell.
Yeah, a kid would certainly buy those because, you know, a parent would buy those because they know The Simpsons on TV. Oh, Bart's a little rude, but still, I don't mind a kid reading a comic book. So you do that, and maybe it is only just the Johnny DC line, or maybe, you know, you start a lighter imprint for the of the Marvel characters. I don't really know. You know, I'm just a guy sitting here blathering. I don't have the sales figures. I don't, you know, I tried talking to one of the guys at the 7-Eleven today. The last one I went into, I actually bought a copy of Juxtapose because I was going like, they sell Juxtapose here. Oh, that's pretty cool. I haven't checked that out in a while. So, you know, I buy an art magazine there. They also sell tattoo magazines. They sell, you know, Entertainment Weekly. They sell gossip magazines, Hot Rod magazines. They just don't sell comic books. Well,
that just made me think. You brought up Archie's and Stuff Digests being sold at those places. Why aren't those new digest formats that Marvel and DC are putting out of, like, the Runways and stuff, being sold at shopping centers and such? Those would get through the diamond lists.
I don't know. Those would get into bookstores. And here's where it's just my blather. For all I know, the guys at the honchos at the big two at Marvel and DC, maybe they've got plans like this in the works. Maybe they've been experimenting. I don't know. I'm just shooting from the hip as a guy, as a loudmouth with an opinion to get across on this, you know, this one time, and saying, as I see it, this is the problem. And we may have, Bob Wayne or Dan DiDio sitting here, you know, saying, well, Paul, you obviously don't know anything. And they could refute everything, you know, they might be able to. That's fine. I'm just, you know, the guy on the street venting and giving my opinion. You know, when I went into the 7-Eleven today and I, the two I went to first, they were pretty busy and I couldn't talk to the guy behind the counter. The third one I went to, I was actually buying something. And when I went up to him, I said to him, do you ever sell comics? What's the 7-Eleven policy on comics? Is there, you know, has it come up? Do you have any knowledge of that? Unfortunately, I chose the wrong guy to talk to because he didn't know what I was saying. Because, you know, talking to him was kind of like talking to a Jawa, you know, because it was just sort of like, you know, don't mean to be as disparaging, but we were not communicating beyond
a big language barrier.
Yeah, there was a big language barrier, and he didn't understand what comics were.
Yeah,
which again is part of the problem. There was a guy there who didn't know what I wanted. He might have, you know, worked at the store too. I don't know. He said, "If you want comics, go to there's a comic book store over in Olive." And it's like, "Yeah, I know. I'm there every week. I go to House of Secrets all the time."
Yeah.
And then he said, well, there's a newsstand up on San Fernando. They have them up there. And I said, okay, I don't have time to drive over there, but it's good knowing that there is a newsstand not far from here where they do sell them.
But how many families go to a newsstand? That's usually old men
you
in the middle of the night.
You go there when you want something they have.
Well, actually, for
you
that matter...
You happen upon that. It's not a point of sale.
Mm-hmm. Actually, for that matter, how many families go to 7-Eleven? Because I wouldn't want a kid going to most 7-Elevens either, because most everybody in there is buying beer and smokes. You know?
Yeah.
But the point is, I think that they're at some point the head honchos are going to have to work together and say, we got to put these in a place where a family can reach them and buy them for a kid. And we have to assure the family, we don't want to bring back the comics code or the ghost of Frederick Wertheim or anything like that. But we have to make sure that the content in this is something that a parent is going to, you know, feel good about giving a kid.
Yeah.
And, you know, and boys and girls, you know, girls and boys for that matter too. Let's put something out there, you know. I would have been happy if Zatanna, you know, if little girls got their hands on that. That was part of the reason.
Yeah.
Sometimes fans complained, oh, she's too powerful, oh, she's too much in control. It's sort of like, yeah, I kind of want little girls to be reading this. I kind of want them to
feel empowered, like they can do anything they put their mind to.
Yeah, okay, she can be changed into a puppet for an issue, but, you know, next time she's going to use her cleverness and figure out a way to come back and you know, and do that. You know, that's fine. There are books like that out there. If not something I do, then, you know, something else, you know, there are many fine books written by many fine writers. Gail Simone always writes with an eye toward fun things for both boys and girls and, you know, older and younger fans. There is good stuff out there, and there's plenty of Marvel stuff that I think is very easily accessible to kids. There's Dark Horse stuff that's just terrific out there. There's all the Star Wars stuff. All that, you know, the Star Wars stuff alone, that should be out at the drugstore and stuff like that, because, you know, that's built in, you know. Mm-hmm. So that's what I'm saying is like, you know, change the line, change the characters, change the outfits, change everything. But for God's sake, just remember, you know, it starts with the parents buying it for the kids. Once you hook the kids in, they'll find the comic book store. One feeds the other. The new, you know, the spinner rack is where it starts for a kid. It, you know, if we're talking in bookstore terms, let me put a different term. I know we're running out of time. If all you offered a kid was the only book a kid got, you know, when he was young, you know, was Captain's Courageous or Jungle Book or even Harry Potter, and said, this is your, you know, we're starting you on something like this, and or, you know, Ray Bradbury science fiction or something, a kid is going to look at that and they're going to, it's like there's no step between reading nothing and then suddenly being presented with a children's classic. And if you look at, you know, equate that to comics and you say, oh, our classics are Sandman and Watchmen and Dark Knight, a kid has no, you know, jumping on point for that. It's just some, you know, whereas in regular, in more traditional children's literature, you've got Dr. Seuss. You even got, like, I Am a Bunny or Pat the Bunny.
We're only starting to make bounds in that. Like, Bone, I think, is a perfect children's classic piece of literature.
Sure. And, you know, and again, you know, that is terrific. And, you know, you start the kids off gradually, and you start them off as readers, and, you know, they'll go from Hop on Pop to more sophisticated children's books, to, you know, from Dr. Seuss to things like, you know, to the more, I'm struggling, what's the next step from Dr. Seuss? There are a few levels before you get to Lemony Snicket and Harry Potter and things like that, but every kid who's reading Harry Potter now is going to be a reader for life. So we want comic readers for life, and we're not getting the little ones in. We're not telling the parents this is okay to buy it for a kid, because we're simply not putting the books out in a place where a parent can get them anymore.
Yeah.
And, you know, that's, once we solve that problem, everything else I think is going to fall in place. So that's my long-winded diatribe. I'm very sorry to hear about a comic book chain that closed up. I hope none of, you know, that's something that's not repeated. I hope this is not the start of a domino effect where a bunch of places go out of business.
Me too.
But I'm saying, you know, we got to start working from the grassroots up to bring in those steady customers, because that's the only way we're going to go.
Yeah. Well, I want to welcome anyone in to continue this conversation on our comment thread on this episode or Facebook or Twitter, and let us know your thoughts.
Yeah, because there'll be, I guarantee, there'll be a few out there who agree with me. There'll be a lot who say that I'm full of crap.
Or somebody will have a brilliant idea that none of us will thought of.
Yeah. So, you know, this, as long as it prompts discussion, I think that's the important thing. Because, you know, all, you know, we need Marvel, we need DC, we need Dark Horse, we need IDW, we need a flourishing comic book business. And it begins with the little ones. And I think this is the time where we have to be more businessmen than fans. And we have to put everything we loved, we have to kind of have to forget everything we love and we want to do, you know, as pros, in order to look back and kind of re-educate ourselves to say, what do we get? What do we put out there that gets a mom to buy it, give it to a kid, that sparks a kid's interest, that keeps them going?
Well, my philosophy is, and it's how I treat any sort of creative attempt, is what got me excited about it to begin with. You know, what, when I was a kid, what brought me in? That maybe that's what we should focus on.
Well, I'll tell you what it was for me. Yeah. I saw it in a place I was taken when I was a kid. There it was. I could pick it up. I could look at it. And that 4 years old, I've never forgotten that Huckleberry Hound comic book. And I've never forgotten the first time I saw Marvel Comics characters was when my dad took me to the barber shop, and there was an issue of Submariner, Captain America Submariner, lying there. And I picked it up, and that was the only thing I wanted to read. You know, it's like, oh, I read the whole thing. Can I buy one of these? Where do they sell them? At the drugstore? Will you take me over there? Hooked for life. So we got to get the little ones in, and we got to get them hooked for life, and that will keep us going. However we go, print or digital, whatever. That's the end of my sermon.
That was a good one, sir.
Thank you. It was a long one, so we might even have, what are we clocking at, 2 hours on this one?
No.
We're at an hour. We're good.
Okay, good. Well, let's wrap it up, and so I'm going to shut my yap for now, and I wish Mike Malby good luck in any endeavor he chooses to pursue, and I hope he gets back into comics before too long.
Yeah, thanks for everyone listening, and keep reading.
Yep.
This has been another episode of Radio Rashi. If you've enjoyed this episode, let everyone know by leaving a review in the iTunes Store. It's a great way to help others find us. You can also leave comments on RadioRashi.com, Facebook.com/RadioRashi, or follow us on Twitter at Radio Rashi or at Paul_Dini to leave us questions. Thanks for listening, and tell your friends.